My name is Valerie Payne, and this is the podcast Binding Unity. I started this podcast because of a personal experience that helped me to see the need for unity in our society right now. I hope that you will come along with me on my quest to find unity as we seek understanding, connection, healing, and love. Hi, this is Valerie Payne, and you're listening to another episode of Finding Unity. And today I have Dr. Lily Anderson on. Dr. Anderson, do you want to say hi to everyone?
Hello.
Thank you so much for being willing to be on. I'm so excited about this conversation. Do you want to start with just giving people a little bit of background about yourself, you know, your personal background, where you grew up, and then maybe just what led you into your mental health profession?
Sure. I'm old enough that this story is a long one, and I'm going to keep it short. it's fun to be at this end where you can see this big trajectory and how life surprises us and takes us places that we would not have expected. And I have truly enjoyed the journey, which is not to say there haven't been the normal challenges and heartbreaks along the way, but it's been a good life. I grew up in the Midwest, mostly. My parents my dad was Mexican, my mother was French, so I'm a first generation American. And eventually they started teaching at Brigham Young University. So when I was starting high school, we moved to Provo, and I finished school there. Went to BYU, got an undergrad in sociology when I was like 9 months pregnant with our honeymoon baby.
Wow.
And so I jumped right from school into mothering, and that was an amazing adventure. I had previously thought I would kind of take more of a professional route like my parents, both of them being college professors. But I really had a very personal experience, and I would say even, you know, kind of a revelatory experience that I had in high school when I was asking about something that led me to feel the importance of full-time mothering when that's possible. And I certainly understand that our world is complicated and it's not always possible, but I was grateful that it was for me. Married a man who was very happy to support that, and so we had 8 kids in 12 years. It was intense and wonderful. And I learned on the job how to parent. I feel like I was really guided by the Spirit and did learn a lot about receiving promptings and revelation during that time as well, because this was all new to me. And I hadn't even babysat when I was a kid because I didn't like children that much. But I did love my own children in a very passionate way. So it was... of course, you know, the hardest job you ever do, as they say, the hardest job you'll ever love, but was so growth oriented for me as well. And my intent to do the best I could for my children, of course, turned into really becoming a better person myself. So that was a marvelous experience about what God can do with us in the trenches. And then I thought that I would go from motherhood to grandmotherhood fairly seamlessly. My husband was a counselor and worked for our church agency, and he got invitations to speak to various groups about marriage and family issues, and he started bringing me along because he knew I loved to teach, and I had a lot of things that I had learned and was happy to share. And I started getting invitations on my own as well. And people even were calling the church agency office asking if they could come to see me as a counselor. And they had to tell them, she's not a counselor. You can't see her because she's not a counselor. So that was kind of a surprising twist again. And then I did get a very clear direction in my own life that was kind of startling and rather upsetting, because I loved being at home full time. But I was given this clear direction to go back to school and get an MSW, the Master of Social Work degree. And I was not too happy about it, but I do trust that higher power and those directions. So I went back to school. Miracles happened, really miracles happened. And we, the kids were great and amazing. And my husband was phenomenal. He immediately took over a lot of the tasks that I had previously done so that I could focus on getting school and going, and did the 2-year degree, finished my internship right around the time we left Las Vegas. We had lived in Oklahoma and then Chicago and then Vegas for several years. And then he got transferred to Utah, and I got another kind of little baseball bat hit over the head that said, to go and do my PhD at Brigham Young, where I did the PhD in marriage, family, and human development. And it was such a great blessing that my own children were coming through campus when I was there. Yeah. So I was on campus with my kids. You know, they would sometimes take classes for me or TA for me or bring in their roommates for free counseling, which was great. And felt very, very blessed. It was a busy life, very busy, sometimes extraordinarily busy. But I have always felt a lot of support from family and from God and my faith. And I really have loved a statement that I read when I was in high school, a pretty young high schooler, by Ezra Taft Benson, that said, if we turn our life over to the Lord, he can make more of it than we can. So that really has been such a truism in my life. I have felt that I have had opportunities I never would have dreamed of at every stage, you know, things that surprised me, that made me more of a person, that I can feel really good about, that I feel like is being, you know, polished in a way, because I think that it's only through challenges that we grow. And I feel that sometimes we have this real orientation in our society towards comfort and towards avoiding uncomfortable situations. And that makes me really sad, because as many of us have heard, we really don't grow when we're in a comfort zone.
Yeah.
And so I have continually had these great opportunities to get out of my comfort zone, and I have grown. Yeah. I can see it. So I'm grateful for that.
That's amazing. And how would you say your doctorate degree in marriage, family, human development, how has that contributed to your practice as a therapist?
Well, you know, the master's in social work is what we call a terminal degree. You don't really need additional degrees in order to have a great profession as a counselor. Right. So it was surprising to me. I was kind of surprised that I felt directed to go back. But it gave me an opportunity to teach on campus for several years after my degree. I was very busy with a private practice as well. Mm-hmm. And so it was challenging, again, schedule-wise. But it was, you know, teaching and practicing at the same time was a marvelous combination, because I could think of the theories involved and how do you transmit this to others.
Yeah.
And even in a preventative way, as I'm working with college students who are just at the beginning of maybe, you know, married life, family life in most cases. And so, you know, here I've learned all this in the trenches. First as a mother and wife and parent myself, but then also in practice with clients, and I'm still in practice with clients, but now how can I help others avoid some of the pitfalls? How can I help them be prepared for how to deal more effectively with the challenges? I love the combination. I loved it. And frankly, a lot of my practice is psychoeducational, I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, because I really do believe in that concept that, you know, if we understand the principles of life, if we understand truth, what works and what doesn't, you know, that's really the best solution to life, is to understand true principles and know how to apply them effectively.
Yeah.
So that was just a wonderful combination. The other great blessing I would say that came from, well, there were many, so it's hard to even limit it, but I had a lot of positive receptivity from the students, and they pushed me to write about what I was teaching, because they would say continually, semester after semester, I'd get this feedback, you know, it's like drinking from a fire hose. We can't write fast enough. And I'm kind of a fast talker. I had a lot of content. I'm not just a storyteller. I like to tell stories as a examples and illustrations, but I have a lot of technical content, and they were having a hard time recording it in a way that they felt like they would be able to take it with them. And so this push was pretty strong, and I ended up having a genius TA that came through one time. He had taken my class, and then he applied to be a TA, and he really added to that pressure. He said, you really need to create a written form of some of these lectures, because they're just really valuable and they want to take them with them. So with his very supportive pushing and helping, I did come up with a book that was sort of a compendium of lectures. It was only like 100 pages, but then we ran out of those very quickly. The students gobbled them up, and then he said, okay, let's not just reprint it. Write a little bit more in each chapter before we reprint. And so that became a book that was about 220 pages long and really has a lot of great content. I'm no longer selling that book, but chapter 3, for instance, became my book, Choosing Glory. And now I'm going back and taking more of that information from one of the other chapters and writing an additional book on boundaries right now.
Oh, that's
so great. Eventually, maybe every one of those chapters will become a book of its own. But that was a real blessing to see how to, come at it from different directions, not just, like they say, the ambulance at the bottom of the hill, but the fence at the top, you know.
Yeah.
How can we maybe help people that way?
Well, I'm excited that you're getting more of these books out so that we can all read them and learn. And I'm excited about the psychoeducational approach that you take, because I think that'll be really helpful in this conversation on the podcast today. So let's just go ahead and dive in, talking about marriage and dating and your experiences as a therapist. So as a therapist, what would you say are the biggest areas of conflict or disconnect that prevent people from marrying in the first place or staying married?
Well, these are not comprehensive answers. Obviously, the issues are pretty layered and complex. So I don't know if I do well with trying to find, the biggest areas. Let me think for a second. What hits me on this topic? I think that we have become a pretty selfish society.
Yeah.
So I think, as we were mentioning a moment ago, people avoid discomfort. And marriage is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some obvious comforts to be gained in a relationship that turns into a marriage. But then you have to live in close juxtaposition with a person who is different from you. And that isn't comfortable. I think a lot of young people have seen their parents' marriages fail or struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they continue, they've seen that it's not easy. It's
yeah.
not always happy. And I think that that creates kind of a fear of that, of intentionally putting ourselves in such a kind of a refining fire situation or, a cauldron that is challenging. There are obvious draws, just to have that intimate relationship with somebody and to, have a stable relationship and to have children if you're interested in that. But there's a lot of fear. And I do think that too much of it does kind of overlap, at least with some of our basic selfish tendencies as
yeah.
individuals, to keep the easy route. I don't want to have to navigate finances with somebody else. I don't want to have to be responsible to somebody else for my time or the expenditure of my time or when I waste time or, anyway, there's a lot of obligation that comes with marriage. My PhD dissertation was a comparison that the university actually requested to be done on the stresses of married students compared with the stresses of married student parents. So, of course, in the literature review, there's a ton of information on marriage stress as well as the stress of parenting. And what are you going to say about that? Yes, it's more stressful than being single.
Yeah.
And it is. So I think the avoidance of stress and discomfort is a big part of that. And as I said, fear that comes from having seen so many marriages fail.
Mm-hmm.
The sexual revolution really did a lot of damage. Let's also mention that, because what's the old bromide? That why buy the cow if you can get the milk for free?
Mm-hmm.
There's some truth to that. So where prior to the sexual revolution, if a man wanted steady access to sexual intimacy and wanted to remain acceptable to society and have some sort of positive position or a good reputation in society, he had to marry a good woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a big push to settle down and to establish oneself in a respectable manner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is gone, because it's not just bad girls that do, it's good girls that do in many cases. And so at least, they're still considered part of a respectable society. So there's a much lesser push toward establishing oneself in a marriage. Okay. I heard an interview the other day with a man who said, I don't see the point in marrying. Again, he had available access to sexual intimacy when he wanted it. And he said, some statistics are indicating that 80 to 90% of divorces are initiated by women. So he said, I'm going to commit to a woman, I'm going to work hard, and then she could end the marriage if she's not happy enough and take half of what I've worked for and take away constant access to my children. He said, I just don't see the benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say, and something I've seen myself, is a lot of anxiety and mm-hmm. fear. And I also like that you added discomfort, that's a huge piece of maybe prevented marriage. And you talked about the sexual revolution. I'm curious what your thoughts are, though, in regards to people of faith, because people of faith who believe in celibacy, how does that play, that piece, would you say, in like fear? Would you say the sexual revolution still applies to that in areas of like pornography and other areas, or do you have any thoughts on that?
There are some interesting findings in some research that show that pornography use is really high in Utah. Mm-hmm. So, and sometimes it seems to indicate that it could be higher in religious populations than it is outside religious populations. And I think that makes sense in some respects. I mean, it's sad, of course, and I don't find it to be useful, constructive, or beneficial in any way, shape, or form. There are a lot of indications that pornography use can also impact marriage very negatively and impact sexuality and sexual satisfaction and just marital satisfaction in really detrimental ways. I think the issue is, though, that again, it becomes this compromise. You know, I mean, I do have these drives and these hormones, and but I don't want to violate my standards, so I'm not going to sleep around. So here's this way that I can kind of assuage that appetite, at least at a level, at a certain level. And I think it becomes a bigger problem than ever, because it's a substitute, it's a counterfeit, and it has all kinds of detrimental effects, as I said. But it does seem to sort of scratch that itch sufficiently to, again, maybe mitigate the natural drive that those feelings might have previously had toward marriage.
Right, yeah.
So I do think we have a serious problem with that. We do see that women are more involved with pornography than they used to be. Hmm. There are a lot of these counterfeits that call on us from all different directions saying, you know, this can satisfy you or whatever. And instead of just facing life head on, one of our leaders, Boyd K. Packer, years ago said that part of that high level of libido and drive that is typical in all of us at certain stages of our life, for sure, but also seems to be particularly high for men, was designed to help men sort of make that commitment, you know, women often are driven to marriage because they want children. So that's a pretty strong drive, a maternal instinct kind of that women have, that I want to have children. And if I have decided to be chaste, then that means I want to be married so that I can bring forth these children in a safe setting, a stable setting. Men may not have as strong a drive toward paternity, but if they had a strong sexual drive and it needed to be within the bounds of chastity, then that also helped to impel them towards marriage. But now, if again, this counterfeit exists where you can, to some extent, you know, satisfy components of that appetite in this artificial counterfeit way, you know, we've got a problem.
Yeah. You know, so in a Morgan Stanley study, it states that Morgan Stanley forecasts 45% of prime working age women ages 25 to 44 will be single by 2030. And President Oakes also shared in a recent devotional that the age of first marriage for members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has increased by 5 years. And so we've talked about anxiety and fear, pornography use, which can be an aspect of anxiety too, because maybe people are feeling like they're not good enough because of, you know, a pornography addiction
these
or something.
Problems that makes them feel bad about themselves.
Right, yeah. Exactly, the shame. Mm-hmm. So what other additional factors do you think are preventing people from marrying that maybe we haven't tackled or talked about?
Well, the whole dating culture has also been altered. You know, for a long time, we talked about how much it had gone toward hanging out rather than actually individual dating. Mm-hmm. And that did create a problem as well. And that just sort of a group hanging out didn't help to develop that those early stages of choosing or committing or at least exploring the possibility of a certain person as a potential partner. And that, I think, still remains. But once we're, and then this is advanced dating, I should say, sorry, the advanced age at marriage, I think it's related to the fact that if people don't marry in college, it's a lot harder to meet people. Mm-hmm. Every semester in college, you've got a whole new set of classes. You know, there are all kinds of different activities and clubs, or, you know, you can go to the games, you can go to different, you know, different areas, service opportunities, whatever, where you interact with a lot of different people and you have many, many opportunities to meet the opposite sex. But once you're past that, I was working with a girl not that long ago who graduated and broke up with her boyfriend of like 2.5 years as she graduated. She had hoped it would turn into an engagement, but she saw some red flags and finally kind of addressed them and broke up the relationship. And she told me in like 2 months later, she was, I can't believe how hard it is to meet new guys. Once you've met everybody in your singles ward and everybody at work, where do you go? And so, of course, they go to these dating apps, which are a disaster. Now, I recognize that some people have success on dating apps, but it is not easy.
Yeah.
It's again, it's sort of contrived. You know, people put certain things forward. There are even some dangers of meeting people online. So hopefully people are very conscious about that. I'm not saying not to use them, because I recognize that there may not be a lot of other options. But you just, I mean, it's very discouraging for people. They go on there, and I hear this all the time from clients, that they just feel kind of yucky about having to scroll through and...
Yeah. I've been there. It's very
profile, you know.
It's very depressing.
Yes. Well, this is what I hear all the time. So, I think that's another problem, that our society isn't really oriented toward marriage. And although marriage in the other church has become something that people do later rather than earlier, that is even more exaggerated in the general population outside the church. So, I feel like too many ways we're just about, you know, a year or two behind the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So we're not really setting a style of our own. We're not really. And then there's also the issue that we have a lot more women who have been highly influenced by the feminist movement, even as members of the church. And that can be a real turnoff for some men. And it would have been for my sons, because they were looking for a woman who wanted to be a mom. And not to think of that in any lesser way. I mean, they saw me be a full-time mom for 20 years and love it. And they knew that I brought every gift or talent that I had to that and felt that it really expanded me. But, you know, the world tells them it turns your brain into mush and that it makes you stupid and whatever. So yeah. Some of them have heard that voice and they've kind of oriented themselves more toward some of those feminist attitudes. And it's, I think that's a problem. I hear from young men sometimes that, like, oh, I'm not so sure, you know, what kind of a mother she would be, or if she would even be satisfied being a mother. I also hear from some young women that a lot of these young men want a second income. They don't want the whole burden of the finances of the family to rest on their shoulders. So they're not as quick to embrace a woman who does want to be a full-time mom. And I know there are exceptions to that. We have a whole spectrum. But those things kind of, you know, narrow the field. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, it can't be just like, well, any member of the church or, you know, any religious person now, you know, we have the expectation of maybe a more traditional gender role, you know, distribution of labor and so on.
Yeah. No, I think there are a lot of dynamics that you've brought up. And one thing that I think is interesting is, well, you know, you talked about dating apps and that. And I've also heard the opposite, where men don't want to date women in the ward because they don't want to, in their words, they call it, quote unquote, pee in the pool.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think there's fear around that. But I also, so I heard you mention once on another podcast, if I'm hearing you correctly, about also women investing or maybe pursuing a man. So we have these problems, right? Maybe there's people who don't want to pee in the pool, or fears about dating or marriage, whether that's fear because maybe, like you mentioned, the feminist movement and how that may have shifted things, fear from both men and women in that area. But can you speak a little bit to just like investing and why that's important? And then maybe we can unpack that a little bit.
Sure. But I should mention one other thing before I do that I can't believe I didn't mention earlier. And that is that I think we are also very influenced by some really worldly philosophies about beauty. Mm-hmm. And I do see this. I know this is sort of a trite element to bring up, but it's important that men are very visual. So although attraction is important to both genders, I think that sometimes men limit themselves a little bit. They want that hot chick, you know? So they can be a little blinded to some of the other characteristics that are much more indicative of long-term happiness in marriage. And so that can create an issue too. Oh, and I will say this, extroverts date more than introverts. I mean, that shouldn't be shocking to anybody. But again, if we don't have men who are dedicated to finding a wife, which for many reasons, as we discussed, you know, isn't so much a drive anymore, or at least not as deliberate or early on in adulthood, then got a lot of more introvert types that sort of fall out of the dating pool. And it's not that they don't want to, but they don't have very many opportunities. And then as they get older, as we said, the problems, you know, just multiplying in terms of meeting people, or, you know, the fears can even increase. The longer you've been an adult, the more selfish you can get without trying to be a selfish person.
Yeah.
But you're the only one steering the ship. So by definition, you start to become pretty darn independent and you get to make a lot of choices for yourself, and it's hard to give that up. So anyway, but this business of investment is also very important. I've seen that, again, it's mostly since the sexual revolution. And let me mention a video that, if you get a chance to, I hope you and your listeners will take a look at this. It's a stick figure kind of video done by the University of Texas at Austin Family Institute. And I believe it's called The Economics of Sex. And it's really well done and explains how the market shifted when women, you know, sort of good women, quote unquote, you know, who may not have been, you know, Christian or faith oriented, started sleeping around. And frankly, that has included a lot of people who do consider themselves spiritual rather than religious or whatever. That's another topic. The point is that it's the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy that seven women are looking to take hold of one man and say, basically, we'll support ourselves. We'll make our own money. We'll handle everything. You know, just let us be married so that it takes away our reproach, or maybe gives us an opportunity to have children. So that has really shifted things. Even, you know, going back to high school, when I was in high school, admittedly a long time ago now, we had almost all boys' choice dances. I mean, there was always a preference dance, maybe a Sadie Hawkins, you know, but it was mostly boys' choice. And now it's at least half and half, mostly in high schools. From what I hear, it's like anybody can ask anybody. Mm-hmm. So there isn't even that shift where, or we had a shift now where men don't have to really pursue even there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really problematic because the investment is so minimal. If women are doing more of the driving of the relationship, then as we know, things are worth what you pay for them. We could even quote Thomas Paine from his early American pamphlet, Common Sense, that helped to spark the revolution, where he said, what did he say? That which we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness, meaning costliness. It is dearness only which gives everything its value, which basically is, you know, things are worth what you pay for them. So if we've got girls who are calling the guys constantly because the guys aren't as driven for whatever reason to cement some kind of relationship or move it, you know, to the next level, and the girls continue to do that, they sort of, you know, try to gently prod or push, or maybe not so gently, but it's kind of like, hey, I've got these tickets, I'll come pick you up and I'll take you and we'll go and have this great time. And the guys go along with it and they have a great time, but they're investing almost nothing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that continues all the way through marriage. Like the girl sort of, you know, says, well, why aren't we getting married, or don't you think, or whatever, and kind of persuades him to marry, and then they marry and she provides everything for the marriage, you know, I mean, I'll arrange the reception and I'll do all this and whatever, and they get married, and then problems emerge because, of course, it's a great refiner's fire and problems are going to emerge when you try to put two lives together. And then she's highly invested in doing the work of getting through the problem or figuring out how to move forward in a healthy and effective way, but he might just say, like, well, it's no longer fun. It used to be fun.
Yeah.
But he hasn't got a lot of skin in the game. So it's easy for him to say, like, I don't want this anymore.
Yeah. So I guess what advice, or what's the balance, or is there a balance for people? Because I've had some male friends say, oh, man, I wish girls would ask more because I don't understand them. I don't, you know. And So I'm just curious, like, where do you have thoughts on maybe if it's okay or not okay, or where the investment should stop or be more equal? Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
Yes, it does. And certainly, I mean, you know, I'm speaking in some general terms, and I recognize that there are lots of varieties, you know, on the theme. So certainly there are some girls who don't encourage enough and things like that, and guys get tired of being the one who's always asking or responsible for actually proposing. I mean, all that kind of stuff can go too far in either direction, no doubt. So I guess what I would say is that there has to be a commensurate investment. We need both parties to demonstrate that they want it to continue. And I would caution people not to marry somebody that you don't feel that kind of investment from. As painful as it might be to step back and say, I think I'm doing all the work here, or at least, you know, the lion's share of the work, it would be much better to step back before marriage and see if that person cares enough to pursue the continuation of the relationship, mm-hmm. or if they're willing to let it drop. Because if they don't care enough to try to, you know, make it move forward, so we're taking a giant risk if we aren't sure that the other person does feel an investment. In fact, I remember counseling with a young woman who was in a very, very much the situation I described. Her boyfriend was very popular in high school, so he didn't have to do a lot of work to date all the time. A lot of girls set things up for him. And it wasn't because he was a bad guy. He just didn't ever have the need to do much of the pursuing on his own. And then in college, that seemed to continue. He had served in Latter-day Saint Mission. He came back, you know, but was still very active and popular in college. And now they're in this pretty committed, exclusive relationship. But the girl was feeling like, I'm not sure how much he drives this. Like, if I don't make plans, he doesn't really make plans. And my advice was, back up. Like, you be busy this weekend, you know, and next weekend if necessary. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, cheating on the relationship, but get with your girlfriends and or go to the library. And of course, now we have cell phones so people can track you, you know, wherever you are. But I was just like, you know, you be busy, you make plans. And if he wants you in his life, he'll make that clear. But if he doesn't, walk away. Yes. And she did. She just played a little bit harder, you know, to find, not in a manipulative game playing way, but just in a realistic attempt to say, how much am I driving this relationship? And as she pulled away, he was startled and was like, well, of course I want to, we're, you know, let's make plans. And, you know, they got married, they had a big family. But she needed to know. She needed to know. And I thought it was important for him to know how much he wanted her in his life.
Yeah. It sounds like the principle you're teaching is like boundaries too. Boundaries for Absolutely. Herself. Yeah. So what I'm hearing you saying, you can tell me if I'm not correct, but what I'm hearing you say is it doesn't necessarily matter about like who initiates first. but more of, is there a continual investment as the relationship is progressing?
I think we need to be pragmatic. So yes, I would agree with that. I don't think there is anything wrong with the traditional way.
Right.
There were so many advantages to that that we have lost to a large extent, but we do have to adapt. And so with the way the culture has changed and society has changed, I think flexibility is fine. I think it's great for a girl to encourage a guy. I think there's nothing wrong with her asking him out, but if it's only one way, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. I think going back to what you said about the feminist movement as well, I know some men who are afraid to ask women out because they're afraid they're going to offend the woman if they offer to pay, if they offer to do certain things. So the culture really has become this odd dynamic.
Where everybody's walking on eggshells.
Yes.
Well, yeah. I would say to that young man, though, what have you got to lose? Ask her. And if she's offended by that, good to know. Mm-hmm. Scratch.
Yeah.
Like, why not just find out rather than tiptoe around it?
It's true. Yeah. So I guess going back, I feel like we've talked about a lot of different aspects of this and relationships. And something I've had just more compassion for is the male perspective. I've talked to some of my male friends who have, you know, trauma and anxiety. That's real anxiety, like you mentioned, maybe from their upbringing or from something that happened to them when they were younger that they haven't quite resolved. What advice? Of course, there's therapy. Maybe you have some tips about finding a therapist that's right, but maybe additional advice or counsel to those men or women who are struggling with that anxiety, trauma that's preventing them from marriage or causing conflict in their marriage relationship?
Well, everybody gets hurt. We all experience a life that is far from ideal. There are degrees, of course, and some trauma is very significant and other hurt or injury is less severe, but everybody gets hurt. Speaking from a Latter-day Saint perspective, we have the real advantage of understanding that this is a necessary part of the plan, that there must be opposition in all things. You have to know the bitter to know the sweet, that experiencing failure or rejection or any number of kinds of injuries are designed as, and this is right from Ezra 12:27, right? That God gives unto men weakness that they may be humble. And his grace is sufficient that if we are humble and have faith that he can make those weaknesses into strengths. That is such a powerful perspective. Now, I've had non-member clients too, and honestly, I just changed the vocabulary a little bit, and I teach the same principle that, you know, if anybody has been to a weight room or understands the concept of exercise, they should understand that, that it's stressing the muscle that gives it the opportunity to grow back stronger. And of course, life and history are full of examples of people who not only have survived in times of trouble, but have learned to thrive. And I feel like we've lost that to a large extent in our society because we have this desire for comfort and protection, and some parents are so overprotective they kind of wrap their kids in bubble wrap, and then those kids continue to wrap themselves in bubble wrap as they grow older, so that they are positively, you know, fearful of encountering trouble or problems or heartbreak. Now, I'm not suggesting we should be cavalier about those things. Certainly, you know, trying to be rational through life can help us avoid a lot of hot stoves and cliff edges. Mm-hmm. And that's to our advantage. I personally believe that that's why God gives us commandments, so that we can avoid a lot of those hot stoves and cliff edges.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, we are all going to get hurt. Mm-hmm. And there is a purpose. The purpose is that we become more powerful, not less.
Yeah.
So I'm really concerned about this. It's sort of a victimhood, you know, response that our society promotes. You know, we all now seem to have diagnoses that we carry with us, you know, these labels that we put on ourselves. Oh, I struggle with anxiety. Except it's not just that. It's not I struggle with anxiety. It's I have anxiety.
Right.
And there's a real ownership of these problems. I have depression. I have it. Or my anxiety, my depression. I really dislike that. I really try to encourage those that I interact with as a clinician or a friend or a presenter to consider changing that perspective and seeing that we're all going to have times where we feel anxious or feel depressed, but we don't have to land there. We need to, in fact, examine those situations and find out where the potential growth lies and then maximize that growth. We are made anti-fragile. I talk about this quite a bit in my own podcast. I have a weekly podcast called Choosing Glory, and this is one of my themes that I talk about anti-fragility. There's an author named Nassim Taleb who wrote a book named Anti-Fragile. Honestly, it's not my favorite book, but I love this idea that he presents in the book, and the book is okay, but I prefer a book written that quotes Nassim Taleb called The Coddling of the American Mind by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff. That's a terrific book. Would encourage anybody to read it. Mm-hmm. The Coddling of the American Mind. And in this idea that they share of anti-fragility, they say that, you know, there are some things that are created fragile, like glass or crystal, or, you know, things that break easily when they impact hard surfaces. And that is certainly true. Then there are some things that are made to be more resilient, like plastic. If you drop it on a hard surface, it probably won't break. It may not be wonderful for the structural integrity of the plastic, but it is built to survive most of those blows. And that's another strata of materials. Then there are some things that are created anti-fragile, meaning that they actually require stress in order to fully accomplish their potential or to optimize their potential. And then the examples that Taleb gives are muscle, which we all know, use it or lose it. Bone, again, if you don't do those weight-bearing exercises that your doctor tells you about more and more as you get older, your bone can become fragile and brittle and more likely to break or fail. And his third example is children, except it's not just children. It's all of us. It's every human being was created by God to be anti-fragile, meaning that the plan of God requires that we experience stress, trauma, pain, injury, failure, in order to optimize our potential.
Yeah.
And if we have that perspective and we realize the power is in us, and a loving Savior, a loving God has created this particular earthly dynamic to the purpose of creating us as powerful, or helping us become these powerful creatures that we were meant to be. So instead of, you know, retreating into our inner child and, you know, putting that bubble wrap around us, we need to look for the meaning, to create the meaning. Viktor Frankl, many people are familiar with him, and if they're not, they should be. A concentration camp survivor who wrote this marvelous book, kind of a must-read book for every person, called Man's Search for Meaning. And in that book, you know, he really talks about, again, the fact that everything can be taken away from us except our attitude on how we're going to respond to the trouble in our lives. Later in his life, I mean, he survived the war, he had another family, worked in hospice for years, did a lot of marvelous things. Good man, amazing life. And later in his life, he used to share a formula that he said really was a key, which was D equals S minus M. Despair is suffering without meaning. That's a powerful truth. Yeah. Despair is suffering without meaning. If people remember their math equations, sometimes we would find an equation that was talking about covariation, meaning that when one of the numbers was a constant, and the others would co-vary, meaning if one was high, the other was low, and vice versa. This is exactly what that formula is. Suffering is the constant because life is full of opposition, and we should not shrink from that. We shouldn't be looking for trouble, but we shouldn't be terrified about it ever, because we are capable. We are built anti-fragile, and with the blessings of heaven, we can overcome all things because Christ has overcome all things. So what are the two covariates? Suffering and despair. Or I'm sorry, not suffering, but meaning and despair. Mm-hmm. If meaning is low, then despair is high. But if we seek out and or generate a meaning to our troubles, despair will go away. So what it's always about making lemonade from lemon. That's what it's always about. It's like, okay, I can't stop the fact that there are lots of lemons in my life, but by George, I can make lemonade. And particularly if I tap into those eternal principles, into the Savior's grace, I can get lemonade from my lemons. God says this, I will consecrate your affliction for your gain. Mm-hmm. That's the entire point. So instead of sitting there in my sadness and saying, well, now I have to avoid this or that or the other, or I better take cover and I better not try this because I've been hurt. Instead of, it's like, okay, I was hurt. What was that for? Mm-hmm. Where can I find a meaning? Where can I create a meaning that changes the way I've experienced that? And instead of seeing it as this huge deficit in my life, I can see it as a stepping stone. Yes, that sucked, pardon the expression, but out of those lemons came this lemonade.
Yeah.
I have a mother who had a very abusive father. I never met him. They ran away from him when my mother was 16. And he wouldn't have let them go. He was a really terrible guy and threatening to kill them regularly and very, very abusive. And she was the nicest person anybody ever knew. So she didn't sit there and say, like, well, I had a terrible father. You know, I'm stuck forever. I've just got to be miserable. It's like, no, what am I going to take away from that? Well, I'm never going to make anybody feel the way he made people feel.
Yeah.
So she became powerful in that area because of her hurt. And it really was a blessing to everybody who knew her.
Yeah.
She was just genuinely kind and good. So, I mean, here's the story too, right? We've got these two men. One is an alcoholic. The other one never touches alcohol. And they're both interviewed, and they ask the alcoholic, why are you an alcoholic? And he says, well, you know, my father was an alcoholic. I have no choice. And then you ask the guy who's stone cold sober, why are you stone cold sober? Why don't you ever drink? And he says, well, my father was an alcoholic. I have no choice. Hmm. And you're like, well, guess what? They made a choice.
Yeah. So I feel like the basic principle too that I'm hearing you say as you were, you know, mentioning everything Viktor Frankl, all of those stories, is it's really about meaning and purpose and looking outward and not inward. And we mentioned briefly too when we were talking, I was mentioning Esther Perel, how she kind of talks about how there's this false sense in our culture of how we have to be perfectly healed before we can be in a relationship. But relationships are what cause growth. And so relationships help that growth and development. And so I feel like that's kind of an important thing to think about too, when we think about when we don't connect or when we look inward, it's preventing connections in all forms of relationships and not allowing an opportunity for meaning and purpose when we're preventing ourselves from developing or creating relationships. So I guess, in closing, and if you have any thoughts on that, feel free to share. But thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate your time, your insights, everything that you've shared. It's been super helpful. Whenever I have people on my podcast, I just kind of ask, what does unity mean to you? And unity, I talk about on the podcast as connection, seeking understanding, healing, and love. So I don't know if you have thoughts on what unity means to you, or any additional thoughts on connection, healing, love that you want to share in closing.
Sure. I like that idea that you're quoting from Esther Perel. I wasn't familiar with her, but I'm glad you mentioned her today, because I always like to hear those voices that are advocating growth-oriented principles, and that sounds really growth-oriented to me. I know that we need reasons to become better. And as much as we can be very selfish and inward focused, honestly, people don't usually get better for themselves. They usually get better for others. So I know that, I mean, I was a pretty happy kid. And when we got married, I mean, I would have thought, you know, I'm a pretty nice person, obviously, raw and not fully grown, not fully mature, or any of those things. But I was a pretty nice person, the kind of person I didn't have enemies. I didn't have conflicts in my life that were significant at all. And yet, I mean, certainly the normal challenges of life, but not interpersonal problems. But when I got married, I realized I wasn't as unselfish as I thought. I thought, how do people even grow up without getting married? Now, yeah. I know wonderful people who have remained single, usually not because they wanted to, and they have found that in their engagement with other people, it may not be marriage, but through their work, through their avocation, as well as their vocation, through service, through church involvement, all those things, they can certainly acquire these wonderful qualities that happen when we put ourselves in close juxtaposition with another person. But marriage is so perfectly designed that way. I mean, I remember, this was the first year of our marriage, I'd made a dessert and I was serving it on these two plates. I was going to take it out to my husband. We were going to eat it in the couch. And, you know, you're trying to put pieces that are about the same size on these plates. Well, one of them was a little bigger than the other one. And I remember my first thought was like, I'll take the big one. And then I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that. I'm just looking out for myself. And because I am religious, I said, you know, like, well, gee, which one would I give the Savior? And that was easy. So I gave my husband the bigger piece. But just thinking like, good heavens, like, I just had no idea I was still selfish. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't obviously selfish as a single person. But you put yourself in a marriage and then you start to see that you really do have these self-serving, impulses. And it gave me a chance to become a better version. I had all those young kids and, you know, as I ran errands, I mean, the older ones were in school and whatever, but as I would run errands, people would ask sometimes, as I had all these children that were similar ages, they'd say, are all those yours? And I would say, no, I have more. And they would ask how many, and I told them, and then almost always, and this was kind of interesting, almost always the next comment was, you must be so patient. And my answer was always the same. I said, well, not yet, but I'm getting there. Because again, you know, you think you conquer selfishness maybe with your spouse, and then you have children and you realize, oh my goodness, there are other ways I can be selfish, or at least impatient. Mm-hmm. Again, I didn't see myself as a terribly impatient person as a single person. Again, I had pretty good impulse control. I had some really good delayed gratification. And yet here as a mother, boy, they can get on your last nerve. And I was like, what an amazing opportunity. And things that I would not have changed for myself, I changed for them. Yeah. You know, they are little monkeys and little mirrors. And so you can easily see your own habits reflected, you know, the way you speak, the way you gesture, the way you do things. And I remember thinking, even things, no offense to my husband, for whom I was willing to make changes, but I felt even more motivated to make changes for my children, because I thought, well, my husband kind of asked for this. He wanted to be married to me. But my children came because we chose to have children. And they're so innocent in this, and so, you know, they're so malleable, that if I don't watch myself, I'm going to give them some bad habits that I don't want them to have. I better get to be a better person. So that idea of, you know, how growth happens in relationships, I could not agree more.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the other choice is that people become more selfish, more stubborn, more impatient. And that certainly is an option. Let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah.
Just being married and being a parent doesn't make you a good person. It's how you choose to respond mm-hmm. to the challenge of those things
yeah.
that can allow for that optimization of our potential and to become a better version of ourselves. But that is a choice that is more available to us when we are in relationships. So yes, I mean, the thought that like you're going to get all perfect and you're going to get all whole and all healthy without, you know, by delaying your life's journey, not so much. Now, certainly if there are, you know, huge hangups that we're aware of because
right.
of certain traumas or whatever, I certainly would say, yes, get going on those
yeah.
in a unilateral way. But that doesn't mean that you stop your social endeavors.
Right.
It means that you're working hard on those things. And then as you interact in social settings or dating or whatever, you know, it's even more motivating to get those things worked out. And there are many people who are happy to work with or form a relationship with somebody who is actually, you know, willing to do the work while they're moving forward. As far as my thoughts on unity, that's a lovely word. And I know that for decades now, I've talked about this as bringing together two things that are different. It's not sameness. If it were sameness, unity would have no meaning. It's things that are different and learning to bring them together with appropriate change and with appropriate value for the important differences. For instance, I think it's a marvelous and miraculous plan that allows men and women I think it's a marvelous and miraculous plan that allows men and women to come together and have the opportunity to be unified. When I value so deeply the differences between men and women, I think the adversary really wants to extinguish those differences. You know, we have this whole androgynous push where, you know, we're all the same, and it's part of a feminist thing too, that there's no difference between the sexes. That's ridiculous. Those differences are precious, but they can become unified when we stop fighting and stop being combative or contentious about them, and instead we blend them, we synergize, because every one of those differences has the potential in a blend, in a collaborative effort, to become incredibly powerful and to bless all those who are influenced by that couple that is unifying, where we, I'm repeating myself, but it really is this. We both value the differences, like the French, you know, vive la différence, they were onto something. It's thank heavens for the difference. And yet, if we focus on how they can blend together and synergize, the power that comes is just amazing. How it blesses children is extraordinary. Now, of course, it doesn't have to be a marriage. We can unify, and I'm a big believer in Zion, and I feel like we really have a long way to go to unify, to be one heart, one mind.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean we're all the same. Mm-hmm. We have our unique differences, but we are all willing to submit to the truth, willing to submit to a higher power, willing to submit to true principles, willing to bring our lives in harmony. That's a word I like a lot, and yeah. I think it really is a good word to put with unity, mm-hmm. is that it's harmony. Coming together in our differences to serve something greater than my individual appetites or desires.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing. Thanks for these thoughts on harmony and being different and being an aspect of unity. So
you're very welcome.
Yeah.
And it's a pleasure to be here.
Do you mind letting people know again about your podcast and your book that's out and the one that you're writing, just so people can keep an eye out?
Thank you. I am doing a weekly podcast, Choosing Glory, that's available on pretty much all the platforms. And I have been a guest. This, what started me on my podcast journey, was that I was a guest on the Follow Him podcast. Okay. And I've been a guest 4 times, and it finally, you know, kind of pushed me toward doing my own podcast, which has been quite a fun journey. Mm-hmm. And then the book that I've written is also called Choosing Glory. I recycle titles if I like them. So that has been out for quite a while. It's available on my website only right now. It used to be for sale different places, but lilyanderson.com can get you to that book. And it's the one I'm writing now is on healthy emotional boundaries, relational boundaries. And it's honestly, it's applicable to everybody.
Yeah.
We live in a world that is somewhat treacherous and dangerous, and not everybody has our best good as their goal. So we do need to have help to navigate this. And sometimes it's sort of a good person's problem or a Christian problem. When we think our only alternative is to turn the other cheek, we end up bruised and bloody. So I offer another Christian alternative. I truly believe that God wants us to be non-victim Christians, where we don't dish it out, but we don't take it either. That's what the book is going to be.
I'm excited to read it. Awesome. Well, thank you again so much.
You are very welcome, Valerie. It's been fun.
Thanks.
Take care.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like it on whatever platform you're listening to. Remember that it's okay to disagree. Unity comes when we can agree to disagree while still maintaining a love for one another. For more on unity, follow us on Instagram at finding.unity or on Twitter at finding_unity.